Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f- So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
They ended up killing Osama bin Laden, but in doing so, Osama bin Laden been replicated hundreds of thousands of times. You might kill a man, but you don't kill an idea.
Hi, this is Christoph Triumph, your man in Sweden, doing interviews in English. Just a quick reminder, Varvet is sponsored by Uber, almost like taxi, but cooler, safer and cheaper. And if you don't already have an Uber account, you should get one. I'm actually considering not renting a car next time I'm going to the US and just Uber myself around New York and LA. So if you don't have an Uber account and are in one of Sweden's two biggest cities, please use the referral code Varvet and you will get 150 Swedish kronor to Uber for. That's going to take you places. So thank you very much, Uber, and thank you, listener, for using this code. Talking to me today is Mr. Robert King. For 29 years, King occupied a cell at the Angola prison in Louisiana. A cell just under 3 meters long, 2 meters wide, with a steel bed and a sink that also doubled as a toilet. In this windowless space, he was in total isolation for at least 23 hours a day. For crimes he says he didn't commit. He and his comrades, Albert Woodfox and Herman Wallace, the so-called Angola Three, have between them served more than 100 years in solitary confinement. All three say they were targeted for their activism as members of the Black Panther Party. King's sentence was overturned in 2001, and together with Amnesty International, he is still fighting for the release of his friend Albert Woodfox, who has been in isolation for most of his 42 years in prison. Mr. Wallace unfortunately died a few years ago. Today, Mr. King is a free man. He's an author, a candy maker, and an activist, focusing on campaigning against abuses in the criminal justice system and fighting for Albert's freedom. And when I met Mr. King, he was in Stockholm to raise awareness around this campaign, and he had some help from Swedish artist Meja, who recently recorded a song to support his cause. It's called Yellow Ribbon, and you can find it on iTunes, for instance. And this interview with Mr. Robert King is recorded on January 15th, 2015. So, Lovisa, please roll the tape. How are you, sir?
I'm okay.
What brings you to Sweden?
The thing that brings me to Sweden, the thing that has been probably propelling me and causing me to travel, you know, for the last 13, 14 years is a campaign to shed light on the case of what has become known as the Angola Three, in which I am the freed member, the only freed member now of the Angola Three. Herman Wallace, he was freed a couple of days last year sometime, but he passed away 2 days after he was...
He got to be free for like 3 days.
About 3 days, yes. Yeah. And then he passed away. He had advanced liver cancer. His case was overturned. It should have happened years ago, but his case was overturned, and he was ordered released from prison on the day that his case was overturned. And he was released from prison, but he died a couple of days later.
And you have done loads of media here, I guess.
A bit, but of course that's usual. Yeah. Wherever I go, if I travel in the country, out the country, if I'm on, you know, speaking about our case, then the media comes around.
How did you get to meet Meja?
Well, actually, yeah, it would probably be better. I met Meja through Amnesty. Actually, Meja read a piece that Amnesty did on Angola 3. I think it was last year at some point. And she read about it, and I think to read her story, she mentioned that she was in, you know, had read the fact that Albert had been in solitude for 42 years, and sometimes she seeks a solitude, and it was by choice, but here was forced solitude, and she decided to read the case, and she was appalled by what she read, and this motivated her to contact Albert in correspondence. They corresponded for a bit, and as a result of correspondence, she learned more. And they developed this corresponding relationship, and she decided to write a song called, you know, Yellow Ribbon. And so my reason for being here is I think she contacted Amnesty, and in collaboration with Amnesty, I'm here to maybe promote her song with regards to Albert, to tie a yellow ribbon in commemoration of him, or A3. I say I'm here to, you know, to kind of support that effort.
And maybe we could play a little of that song, of course, in the show. But
of course.
Yeah, but that's fantastic. And for the listeners who aren't familiar with Meja, I can tell that she's a Swedish artist. Mm-hmm. She had a huge hit. What can it be, like 15 years ago, something like that? All About the Money?
And, All About the Money.
Yeah. Okay, sir, so you have, for the last almost 15 years, worked to sort of raise awareness about your case and mm-hmm. about the Angola 3. You were in isolation for almost 30 years. And mm-hmm. because I know that your body sort of, anyway, a couple of years ago, you still felt it sort of in your body, and you still suffer from parts of isolation. Could you tell me how it has affected your person physically? And
well, you know, I imagine now, you know, being in prison, period, can impact you psychologically and physically, and also, but it can be exacerbated. This situation is exaggerated when you are placed in a solitary confinement in a cell that is 6 by 9 by 12 feet long for 23 hours a day, and sometimes 24. It can impact you not just physically but psychologically as well.
Of course.
You know, people ask me, well, how did it impact me? I'm sure I'm impacted by it. You cannot get dipped in waste and not come up smelly. You cannot go through certain, you know, experiences and not have some impact or effect upon you, even if this effect is not apparent or is not really seen. With me, however, and I think with Albert and maybe some other people, I think the idea of resiliency and being able to absorb the impact of prison and solitary confinement was something that I don't attribute to my own statue. I think there was some external forces that allowed me to do this. And the external force that allowed me to do this is I had become, at a certain point in my life, politically aware of what was happening. And so developing this political consciousness, I was able to weather whatever storm it may have been, because I was able to put into context my experience and why I was going through these experiences. And being able to put that in context kind of served as a flotation for me to survive. But you need to know this, and I let people know this, that it's kind of hard to get dipped in waste and not come up smelling, even if the impact is not seen, it's felt, and it impacts you in some way. And like I say, even if it is not seen, you're impacted by it. But I think I have managed well with the fact that I have this buoyancy, this sort of like insulation that have shielded me with this consciousness, this political awareness as to why things were like they were.
Are you bitter?
You know, people ask me that quite a bit. Am I bitter? And they ask me, am I angry? Am I bitter? I don't think I'm bitter. Or if I am bitter, I'm bitter enough to want to do something about this. There is a, not so much as a bitterness. I think that's too steep of a word. It's more like a indignation. Mm. And so like a benevolent, or some people call it a righteous indignation. So it's a benevolent indignation that I have. And so that is my beef. But this does not drive me to be bitter, because bitterness in the sense of bitterness, if I understand that particular term, it can only get in the way and impact what you're trying to show. So bitterness has no real place. But there is a benevolent indignation, and this is what motivates me and drives me to do what I want to do. So I can't say I am, you know, bitter. And people ask me, am I angry? If you ask me, am I angry? Of course I'm angry, and I'm angry enough to do something about it.
Yeah.
I was released February 8, 2001, and nearly, you know, 14 years ago. And since that time, I've been traveling, you know, trying to shed light on our situation, the situation that I went through, and the situation that Herman, before he passed, went through, and what Albert is going through now. But of course, there is a much broader picture. Ours was just a tip of the iceberg. There are so many people who did not or was not fortunate enough to get the kind of platform that we've had, or get the support that we had. When people learned about our case, it became public knowledge, and people got on board and rallied. And it started out as a local support group, and it has now become an international movement, so to speak. Not so much as an international movement within itself, but it has kind of collapse with the other movements that reflects on the same thing on a much larger scale. Mm. But tale of the story of the Angola 3 fits right into all of this, and so this is where we are now.
Did you know already on the inside that once you are free, that this was what you were gonna do?
I had no idea. No,
okay.
That was not a plan at all. None of this was actually planned. We did not even dub ourselves the Angola 3. Once people found out, a former friend and a former member of the Black Panther Party who, like we were, he was a member of the Black Panther Party, and he realized that we were in prison, you know, for a couple of decades. And what he decided to do was he got a group of anarchists and a group of grassroots people to begin writing Herman and Albert initially, and to go visit Herman and Albert, and then later it extended to myself. And we had been, all three of us were in CCR. This was a place in Angola known as CCR, which means close cell restriction, which means solitary. And we had been there longer than any other prisoner. And so we became known as the Angola 3 by the group that started visiting in those initial years, which was sometime around maybe the late 90s.
After 29 years, when you step out of the prison, what was that like? I mean, to set your feet on your on regular ground.
I know what you mean. Yeah. I knew exactly what you mean. It's kind of hard to describe. It was surreal. I mean, I had been in prison for a total of 31 years, more than 31 years, in fact. And it was kind of hard to conceive. And I had a huge sentence. I had a sentence that would not allow me to ever be free again. Of course, I didn't believe that because I fought against it. But there seemed to have been no way out. And once I saw that there was a possibility of my being released and then ultimately released, it was surreal. It was kind of hard to believe. It took weeks for me to not wake up from a sleep and saying to myself with elation, I'm free, I'm out. Or not so much as being free, but I'm out. Am I really out? So it was something like that.
What was the first thing you did?
I guess there was a number of firsts. Because when I was released I was released the same day I went to court, and the people who were in court with me at the hearing, they followed me to the gate, and they waited outside the gate. I was supposed to be released the next day on 12:01. But the warden realized, and then they realized that they had miscalculated my time, and actually I was overdue. So the warden decided to release me on that very day. And so when I was released into in the midst of a group of people who had been in court that I had no idea was waiting at the gate for me. And so I met a bunch of friends and supporters who had become friends and supporters of Angola 3, and they were glad to see me and glad to embrace me. And so we all got into calls, and we driven away from Angola, and I went to my aunt's house. But the first thing I did was, you know, embrace the group that had, you know, supported us all you know, the years, you know, before I was released from prison. So that was the first. People asked me, what did I eat? I can't recall.
Exactly.
I think the thing that I really wanted was something that I really didn't get. But what I did, I made it simple. I got a roast beef sandwich.
Yeah?
Yeah, I got a roast beef sandwich. And then the next day...
Was that something that you had sort of dreamt of?
No, it's something that I hadn't dreamed about, a roast beef sandwich. The thing that I really wanted, I got it, I imagine, the next day or two after I was released. And I had an urge over the years for a lemon, to see a real lemon and to, you know, I used to like to, when I was a kid, take peppermint or take sugar sometime and put in a lemon and to get the experience of that sweet and sour taste. And so the mint, sweet, sour taste of lemon, I had missed that over the years because when I was a kid, I used to eat that. And so what I did was, if someone saw me with a peppermint stick the next day walking around with a lemon, you know, sticking it in, it was because of that. Yeah. I think that was one of the first thing that I did. Yeah, one of the first thing that I did that I had wanted to do for years. Of course, everything else came in succession. I'd done a number of other things afterwards, but the lemon, it was the first thing. And leaving prison in the midst of a lot of supporters, that was, and, you know, greeting them and thanking them, that was, you know, one of the first things that I did.
Yeah. If I was to be in prison, I have been in prison for 12 hours, I think.
Mm.
And I didn't have the time to sort of have any idea. I just wanted to get out. But except for that, I guess that, I mean, food would be such thing that you would dream about. Mm. I mean, is food okay in prison, or was it?
Well, it depends on where your food isn't that bad. It's palatable. You could eat it, of course. There are certain food that you never got that I've since in the ensuing weeks and days that I was out, I got those food that I didn't get. But that was something that I really wanted. It was the taste of good food, which was very, during that period of time, the food wasn't very good, not taste-wise anyway.
Mm.
But food was one of the things that I wanted to experience, and I had my share of that. I did. All the food that I missed in the ensuing weeks, I got an opportunity to experience and to eat all that food.
You had a family when you went into prison?
I had a family when I went into prison.
Did you still have a family when you came out?
30-some years later, 31 years later. So, of course, I had married, and my wife had a son in those years, the early years. So my son, as a result of an accident, he fallen from a window, two-story window, and he developed a tumor as a result of it. During that time, the doctors did not detect that he had developed a brain tumor, and he was bleeding. Oh. He had hematoma.
Okay, I'm so sorry.
And he died. And so I had an immediate family, my wife, and, of course, our separation, you know, being separated, she ended up remarrying, going to California, which is cool, okay. I couldn't fault her. I couldn't bring her to prison with me. And not that I would have, even if I could have, but she would have come either way. I couldn't blame her, you know.
Mm.
But I had another extended family. I had uncles, aunts, cousins. And I still have a aunt, uncle, and first, second, third, fourth, fifth, probably six cousins.
Yeah.
So I have a huge extended family, but immediate family was gone months after I was arrested, which was really in the early 70s.
It must have been so strange. Did you get to watch television and so forth?
At different points in time in my incarceration, where I was placed, we weren't allowed television initially. But what we did, we filed different lawsuits and different grievances stating that we had a right people on death row had television, and we didn't begrudge them. We felt that CCR should have television as well. And so it was during that time they decided to put television on the till, not in our cells, but out on the till in front of our cells where we had to watch through the bars.
Okay, yeah. I'm thinking that because when you stepped into prison, the society around you sort of must have been another world when you stepped out.
Of course. During that time, technology had risen to a pretty high degree. I mean, you know, there wasn't a mobile phone at the time, a computer, IBM machine, but they had no computers.
No.
And so I stepped out into a world that had become very technological. And, of course, don't get me wrong, we were in prison and we kind of kept up with current events. So we understood what was happening. Having television, and we were allowed, even when we didn't have television, if you could afford a radio, we were allowed to have radios and you could listen to certain news and find out exactly what was going on. While you could not partake in it or participate in it, what you could do is realize that these things were taking place. You had an idea of what was going on. And with the television itself, you could see some of the stuff that was going on. So, and then you could feel and see the changes. This was the time, this was during the Vietnam War. The Black Panther Party was in the heyday at this time. You had students protesting all over America with regards to the Vietnam War. And most of these students, Kent State, Ohio State, Jackson State, most of these students from Kent State, Ohio State, who were students that were shot and killed by the National Guard for protesting the war, they were whites. And so my point is that there was an unrest in society with regards to how the American government, how the political wheel of the American government were spreading the sum of what people considered corruption and devastation all over the world by bombing Vietnam and going, you know, people suffering as a result of interference in their political and lives. And so it wasn't just the influences were out there. It's sort of like, you know, revolution. When I say revolution, not so much as violent, anything like that, but things were evolving and people were, all of this evolution or revolution was in the air and it was catching. And it was something that, you know, in hindsight, in retrospect, I consider it was beautiful because it was part of my growth. It helped me to grow. It helped me to realize just why things were like they were. And at the same time, when they did send me to prison and I was placed in a 6x9x12-foot cell, it kind of put things into context as to why it was happening. Mm. I was able to weather that. The stone, because I was able to put it in the context, okay, this is why they are doing this.
Yeah.
So I was able to deal with it better.
Were you thinking about suicide, for instance?
That can happen. No, I'll say this, you know, the contemplation of suicide was something that I think I wanted to do it. I can't say that I contemplated suicide. I think I needed to shed light on what was going on and being politically aware and being able, like I said, put things in context. Suicide was an option, but it wasn't an option for me. If I was going to commit suicide, it wouldn't be self-inflicted. It would be based on some being impelled to do something to force them to kill me. Other than that, I would not self-inflict. You know, I had no suicidal tendencies. I didn't feel that I was in a desperate or hopeless situation because there were other people who felt the same way I felt. So it meant this, that it gave meaning to what I was going through, but it also gave meaning to life, mm-hmm. that I should live. And I began to, you know, that I wasn't going to allow myself becoming to be, you know, to inflict self, you know, death on a death on myself. It just, I wouldn't make no sense. I figured that if my life would be much more meaningful if I lived out my life, define it, continue to define it, and let people expose just exactly what was going on, then I think, you know, I had to feel that my life would be much more meaningful. No, I did not. If the thought of suicide ever occurred to me, it was a fleeting thought.
Okay.
I can't say it never occurred. I have no recognition. But if it occurred to me, I would say this, that if it ever came to my mind, it was a fleeting thought, and that had no place to take roots nowhere in my being.
Did you think about escaping?
Yes, indeed. Yeah. I escaped out the New Orleans Parish Prison. Now, before I was sent to prison, I escaped because I was sentenced unjustly. They had offered me, that arrested me on a charge that I was not, so-called perpetrator did not remotely resemble me. They offered me a 15-year sentence. I refused to take it. And they brought me to trial and gave me a 35-year sentence. And when they gave me a 35-year sentence, it was in a 10-2 verdict. 10 people were persuaded to say that I did, but two people insisted that I did not do it, but that was a majority. And so instead of the 15 years, they gave me 35 years. And when they gave me 35 years, it was at this particular time, I really began to put things into context because I had, by this time, developed a political consciousness. I had came in contact with some members of the Black Panther Party by this time. So when they sent me to prison in May 72, I was able to put things into context.
Do you believe in God?
I believe I'm very spiritual. People ask me that all the time. I think we are gods. I think we have this ability. And if you believe the Bible, you believe Jesus. And I've read the Bible. I read the whole 66 books, the 39 in the Old Testament, the 27 in the New. So I read from Genesis to Revelation, you know, from Genesis to Malachi, from Matthew to Revelation. So, and then I was baptized when I was 9 years old. My grandmother, whom I call mother, raised me. And so I went to church. We were forced to go to church. So I had the traditional belief in God and Jesus, you know, being the Son of God and so forth and so on. And I had that concept, but it was more of a religious, I call that, you know, religious nature. I had no what I call spiritual contact with a super or a supreme being, whether it was myself or whether it was some other source. But I had, you know, it wasn't until I think that I became politically aware of what was going on when I learned the history of oppression in this country, especially with regards to Black people, I developed a spirituality about this that surpassed religion, because religion to me could not put into context. Religion to me is a system of belief that allow you to accept suffering, believing that this is your destiny and so forth and so on. I had remembered Martin Luther King. I also remember Malcolm X, but I remember people before Martin Luther King and Malcolm X. I learned throughout the course of my confinement, this particular time, I learned about chattel slavery, the fact that we were, you know, Blacks were considered subhuman, and you know, and I understood all of the people back then, Harriet Tubman, Sojourner Truth, these other people, Frederick Douglass, W.E.B. Du Bois, all of these people, you know, fighting. I remember reading about the Niagara Movement, which later became the NAACP that was established way back in 1909. I remember Elijah Muhammad. I mean, all of these people who were speaking, but about the condition, the past condition and the present condition of Blacks in society. But these are the things when I embrace this knowledge, I think this served more to give me the spirituality that I need, that kind of give me the buoyancy that, in spite of the fact that I had read the entire book, that I had embraced a religion that my mom and my family had embraced, that did not sustain me. It was the fact that I think my spirituality came when I learned of my destiny, when I learned what was destined for me and my people in a society that was built on oppressing certain people based on the color of their skin. When I realized this was going on and I saw the hypocritical aspect of it, because on one hand, it says one thing and on the other hand, it does some other thing, I think my spirituality developed. And my belief, and not religion, but my belief in something much greater than myself, it really developed. But then again, I also developed and evolved to the point of believing, you know, that we all are, and that we all are to some degree gods. We just have to reach that point. And of course, we come in contact with that, quote, that supreme us, a supreme being or whomever. But I do believe, yes, I am very spiritual, but I'm not traditional.
No, you don't go to church.
I don't know. I don't. Of course, I attend church. I'm not at Boyce or Gone, but I do not make it a regular be because, let me tell you, you got more devils in church than anywhere else. So but I think my belief is in my heart. What you do in your heart and what you do in your life is what you project to the world is how people define you or what people should define you from, and not the fact that you have to go to a church in order to exhibit this. You do not have to enter a church to do this. I don't know no commandment that tells anybody except a commandment from some individual who may have a church and they tell you, well, this is the way it goes. Oh, that's nice if people want to do that. I think I don't have to go to church in order to be in touch with the Supreme Being.
Is there still racism in the United States of America?
Yes, there's still racism, of course. Race, the system was founded upon racism. Racism permeates the society. And the fact that people will tell you, you know, now they would probably use the fact that they have elected a black man as president as a barometer to try to project the fact that racism does not exist. Racism still exists. It was the system, like I said, itself was founded upon discrimination and racism. And then the way President Obama was treated, and to some degree still, but like I say, he's a fighter and he's doing much greater than anyone I've ever seen in my lifetime. But you know, the fact is this, that many people believe that with the fact that he was elected, that racism does not exist anymore. In that society, the fact is this, that it exists much more, and you could see when he was elected how people in the Republican Party, the Tea Party, and how they reacted to his and other people around the country. But the majority of the people elected him president. I'm not saying when I say racism is still in America and that it permeates American society. I'm not painting a broad brush saying that every white person in America are racist. That nothing could be further from the truth. I know better than that. But I know we live in a racist system that operate in discriminating against certain people. And I do know that there are even whites who aren't racist that had never made the connection of the privilege that they can have in their white skin, and that this privilege is not according to people who have a different skin color. And I think people are catching up with this now. I think whites have begun to realize that they have privilege in the fact that they are white. They have the privileges that kind of elevate them to that degree. But the point is, everyone in America, we live in a society, a capitalist society that is based on profit. And the profit goes to the few, not to the majority of whites, even though this is something during slavery. You know, whites, you had only about, maybe 10,000 people who owned slaves. All the rest of the 10, 12, 14 million whites, they were considered poor whites. And some went further than that in describing them, but they were considered poor whites. They had nothing. You know, but nevertheless, the fact that they were able to take refuge in this whiteness, saying that, well, I'm better than you because I could never be a slave. You're a slave. And they had some slaves who lived on a plantation, lived better, you know, because they were provided, but they were property. Yeah. They ate better. You know, they may have slept better. They may have been much warmer, but it's like you treat, you know, you treat your property and you kind of treat it as if you don't want it to go to waste, you know. So you kind of cull it. But whites were not slave. And so they couldn't be culled. They couldn't be protected as property the way, you know, blacks were. So this is the reason why you say, well, slaves may have lived, quote, better at this particular time. But the fact is this, that they took consolation. They consoled whites at this time, consoled themselves, you know, with the knowledge that they could never be slaves, no matter what, and that no matter how down they were in the society, they weren't slaves. So, and that they were better. But But as time went on, all of this, I think the fact that they were white and they had privilege in their white skin showed up, because that takes place. Now, you can see that, how whites in certain job situations, whites get the better jobs in still in most cases in some employment. Not everywhere in the States, but whites are really destined for the better jobs. They get more pay in certain, in many instances, still in the state than blacks for doing, and blacks can do, in some, most cases, do a much better job at it than whites. But nevertheless, they are relegated in pay scales to getting less than a white counterpart might get for doing the same job or for a lesser job.
How could you change this? How could America change this?
I think that could be changed because people are becoming knowledgeable. When people realize that, and I think that change started coming way back, but I think I've seen a big leap in that when I was in New Orleans, Louisiana, during Hurricane Katrina. And that city was devastated. I did not leave. I stayed there the time. A friend of ours, Malik Rahim, he developed Common Ground, a former member of the Black Panther Party. He opened his mother's house up and developed. He did not leave either. He was on the West Bank of New Orleans in a place called Algiers. And his home served as the first distribution center. He had been in touch with activists and people whom he knew, and he reached out to people, and the word spread that people in New Orleans needed help. But what they saw, or what they didn't see, I'm talking about many people, especially white and young white, what they didn't see was the American government, the system of the state of Louisiana, trying to aid the people who were being affected and afflicted by Hurricane Katrina. I think this opened up in a canal of compassion. And not only a canal of compassion, but it also opened up a window, and they began to see that, wait a minute, why are these folks being treated like this? I'm talking about the younger people. I ain't talking about the older one. And they began to question this. But the point is, they began to flock down to New Orleans in hordes to give support to people in New Orleans that the government refused to give any aid to. And I think not that this was the beginning, but this was a high point in evolution in this society, where people who formerly distanced themselves and took refuge in the fact that they were white and that it wasn't being done to them, they say, hold up, wait a minute, you're doing this in our name. That was the statement. We're not going to let you do this in our name anymore. And they showed their support to people who were neglected by a government that alleges to protect everyone. They saw the hypocrisy of it. And where they said, well, no longer will we take refuge in the fact that we are white, that we have privilege because of our skin color. We have this kind of privilege. Everybody should have the same kind of privilege. And when everybody don't have it, nobody has it. And I think this was the approach. And this is the approach now, I think, in many whites and people around the world, I've come to realize. And not just in America, not just in Louisiana where I was born, but all over the United States, people have begun to realize, because I go to many colleges and universities and I speak to a lot of people with regards to our case. But it is always, I put it on a much broader scale, because it is not just our case. It's just, this thing is much bigger than the angle of three. It goes beyond that, like prison. I focus on prison and solitary confinement. It is much bigger than angle of three. That the fact that I was kept in a cell for 31 years, or 29 and 31 total, and Herman and Albert were there. Herman, before he died, more than 42 years, and Albert is still being held in solitary confinement. You know, the fact that it still remains that he's in prison for those many years. But the point is this, that we whites, the many people have gotten on board, and they realize that there is something drastically wrong with the system, and the system that we live in, that is in America, and how America treats some of its citizens. And I think they have taken a different attitude and a different approach. So can it be changed? Is it being changed? Of course, the change is slow, but I can see the evolution. Mm. I can see the change. I can see the, people makes the difference. it is not the political system. I mean, the political system, we can, you know, relinquish our voice right to politician and believe that they're going to get things right. But it is the people who actually get things right.
And quite recently understood how schools are financed in the U.S., that rich neighborhoods, their schools get more funding than poor neighborhoods.
Mm-hmm.
You sort of keep structural differences between classes sort of mm-hmm. with that system.
Of course.
Will racism be gone in 100 years?
I don't know if racism will be gone in 100 years. It could racism, but systemic racism is something that could be eliminated.
Yeah.
Individual racism, maybe organization racism. I think people have to deal with that themselves. Racism can, you know, but when there's a system that perpetrates racism, that embraces this racism, that is when it becomes systemic. This is when racism is when the system practices racism. The fact that there might be organizations, there might be individuals who have a racist organization that discriminate against people based on the color of their skin, it really wouldn't make a difference if the system itself was totally right. And the system is not totally right because racism is still part of the system itself. Will that be undermined? Of course. I think younger people today and people being hired today, people in places today, I think it makes a real difference. It does. It makes a difference. And I think racism can be ironed out systemic-wise in perhaps less than 100 years. But I cannot quite say the same can be applied for whether or not individuals who chooses to be racist by ignorance, that is their karma. But they won't be able to practice their racism through systemic means. And I think if we eliminate racism systemic-wise, I think it's just a matter of time before racism will be eliminated. How long that will take, I have no idea. But it doesn't and should not have to take 100 years. I think we have been propelled in a direction that has accelerated, and we are moving forward real, real, real fast. And where we are going, we are getting there pretty fast.
That sounds hopeful.
Yeah.
If I could sort of make you the president of America in this instance, what would you do about the justice system?
I see.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Is that, I think someone else being president, what it should be done. I don't think I don't think I would want to become president of that system.
But no, you are
hypothetical. I'll answer my answer won't be hypothetical. But I think a person who become a president of the United States, the Justice Department, it depends on whom. You know, we live in a system where there are three branches of government. People ask, well, why don't President Obama do something? And it's a legitimate question, why won't he do something? But the point is, he can't do anything. When I say can't, not so much as he won't. He can't because we live in a system, a legal system, that denies him the right to interfere in an issue such as ours. He is over the executive branch of government. You have the Justice Department, of course. Holder can be, it can filter through him. But then you have each state that is sovereign, and you have people who are part of the justice system within that particular state. They are it's set up that they could operate what they call on a sovereign basis, and they can do certain things in a certain state that Obama can have no. In other words, because he's over the executive branch, you got the judicial branch and you got the legislative branch, and all of these function in different manners. And while Obama can pardon a federal prisoner, legally he cannot interfere in state prisoners. And we are, you know, we were state prisoners. But what he can do, the Justice Department, it can, with all the clamor, with what is going on, it can be filtered down to Holder, who can have impact on different other system within the state. Holder's office is over all of this entire, you know, his, he is over whatever the Justice Department is, he is over all of this. Things would have to come from his office. And there is, to this degree now, as a result of our efforts. And when I say our efforts, I'm talking about people collectively as a whole. There will be in Louisiana, like elsewhere, there's an investigation into the justice system, you know, how they deal with state prisoners, how they deal with criminology. And there is an effort to not so much as reform that, but to investigate it and to eliminate it, hopefully, but for sure to investigate the justice system in Louisiana. We had a representative. He was representative. He's now a congressperson. He's in D.C. now. He was in Louisiana. He was a representative in the state, you know, house in Louisiana. He's now a congressperson in D.C., and he can kind of make things. He have already initiated hearings, future hearings into the justice system in Louisiana and how it impact. Holder has already stated, and even President Obama has stated, that the criminal justice system, how it impacts minorities and blacks much more than it do other folks, and that this is something that they have to deal with. And so we're at a point now where people are discussing this. People in high places are discussing this. So do I think, well, there will be a change as a result of, you know, of course, there will be a change because people want to change. There are so many people out crying, you know, out pouring out their hearts that what's being done is wrong. And I think all of this will impact. And I think if people are the ones who will make the change, and I think people are pushing for change.
Yeah,
this come about as a result of their getting knowledge as to what is going on. And like I say, when they saw, they had visual pictures and of the impact of when a government neglects a people, what happens. And I think people want to change this.
If it were up to you, would there be a death penalty at all?
No. No, it wouldn't. And I say this because I have three reasons. I mean, there are a million, but there are more. But I have three reasons why there shouldn't be a death penalty. One is Albert Woodfox, Herman Wallace, and myself. Mm. I say this because had not it been for this moratorium on the death sentence that was placed on it by the United States Supreme Court in Furman versus Georgia, Herman Abbott and I would be dead now. I wouldn't have never gotten out. Herman would have died not just last year. He would have died sometime in the 70s, and Albert would have been executed also sometime in the 70s. It was because of this moratorium placed on the death sentence that we weren't executed. And the fact is this, that they would have executed myself, Herman, who subsequently got his charge, throw it out, that, in other words, when Herman died, his sentence was overturned completely. He was innocent when the judge overturned his case. But had he not lived up until last year or year before, he would have died in 72. So, and I would have died much sooner. I wouldn't have never got out of prison because they wanted to really execute us. It just so happened there was a moratorium on the death sentence. And so, yeah, those are the three reasons why I think there should not be a death penalty, because the system is set up and designed in such a way that they could execute you legally, but you could be morally innocent of the crime in which you died for.
Of course. And that happens.
It happened. Happened over and over and over. And so that's my reason.
But is it also, I mean, if I would think why about my moral grounds, sort of, probably my first argument would be that it's so strange that if somebody kills someone, that you sort of lower yourself to the killer's level.
You do the same thing.
Exactly.
Right. And, well, and this is what it is. It's retribution. It is not justice.
Exactly.
It is not the justice for people that, you know, the people have been offended by the fact that this individual was convicted of murder. Therefore, the people, in the name of the people, we are going to kill you. No, it is not. There may be some individuals and some people who may want this to happen, who may people who may have been impacted, people who see themselves as a victim or who may have been victim might be persuaded. But the majority of the people don't. Now it is, they don't believe in the implementation of the death penalty.
I'm thinking that when Osama bin Laden was killed, that I'm not sure. I wasn't in the U.S. by the time, but I would assume that there was a majority that thought, well, that was a good thing because he was behind 9/11. Would you say that it's the right thing for U.S. to do, to kill Osama bin Laden?
Well, I wouldn't know. Like I said, that is a branch of government that I do believe this, that America saw itself as being in a war, and not that it's justifiable. They saw Osama bin Laden being behind or the mastermind, and I think from what I gather, he had admits this, and in doing so, I think this, that, you know, it would have been, you know, America get away, people kill all the time. Governments around the world get away with killing people all the time. It is too bad, you know. I imagine when 9/11 occurred, America, you know, intent was to kind of undermine or eliminate that particular source. And they were persistent in doing so, and they ended up killing Osama bin Laden. But in doing so, Osama bin Laden been replicated hundreds of thousands of times. You might kill a man, but you don't kill an idea. And I think in order to kill an idea, you have to undo what raised that idea. How did ideas emerge in the first place? Because if you don't do that, then there will be other idealists. There will be other people who will have better, greater ideals, and ideals that are much more, that can be much more embraced than what Osama bin Laden, than how he was able to persuade people. So you have to, governments involved will have to, you know, they will have to solve that particular problem. But I do say this, that the killing of Osama bin Laden is not the end of the problem. And I think we see that today. Again, for instance, like the Black Panther Party's idea was, perhaps to try to change the system, to make the system more democratic. They destroyed the Black Panther Party as an organization, but the idea that the Black Panther Party had still exists. So,
of course.
Yeah. So they won't. Yeah, you know, Osama bin Laden has been replicated hundreds of thousands of times. He's not dead because his idea still exists, and more people have embraced whatever idea he may have had. So the war goes on. How it will end, I have no idea. But I'll keep doing what I'm doing.
How old are you, sir?
72.
You look like you're in fantastic shape.
That's cool. Thanks a lot.
Do you work Exercise? Out?
I do. And while I was in prison, you know, we were in our cells and we did a lot of exercise, individual exercise. And I used to do
push-ups,
side setups, whatever you call it. And then there was a thing that I did called mental size. In other words, I used to lay in my bed and see myself exercising. I call it mental size.
Okay, and that works out?
It worked for me.
Oh, okay, cool.
But I also did strenuous exercise. Mm-hmm. We weren't allowed to come at one time, go on a yard, but we were allowed 1 hour out in the hall for ourselves, and I used to run up and down the hallway to see how many times I could run that 150-yard or 75-yard in the hour that I have, or in the amount of time that I get before I needed to shower. So, and then again, that at night, even though we were in closed cell confinement and we wasn't in contact with each other, we developed a routine, a couple of us, people who were next door to each other. We used to get up every morning, we learned the exercise that we would do, like side straddle hop, push-ups, set-ups, something like that, or deep knee bends, or butterflies, we would call that, and we would do this. We did this for years. So I think that kind of contribute to the fact that I'm in some shape. Now, and then I still exercise
you do.
To some degree. Now, not as much as I used to. I can't, but I do exercise.
Okay.
And mental size.
Yeah. Your tattoos, have you done them yourself?
Some of them, but they don't mean a thing. Most of them were did when I was about 16 years old.
Okay.
Yeah, I was about 16 years old when that happened.
All right. I see that, you know, that this is actually a Swedish name. That's my son's name.
Love.
Love, yeah.
Love. Okay, yeah, so yeah. What we say, our mother's love, we pronounce like, you know, someone love you.
Yeah.
Mother, nobody love you like your mother. And that's what it was. And that's what I saw here. Nothing, another heart with someone oral. It was a person in my life, my aunt, who died young. And she was really my friend. That was, you know, another something I considered a rose. But nothing, it didn't have any meaning. It was my own personal meaning, and nothing that had any real significance.
You were born in the 40s in Louisiana. Mm-hmm. You said earlier that you see why you sort of got imprisoned. Because you became a criminal quite early on.
No, I didn't become a criminal.
Okay.
I think criminality is a mentality.
Okay. Sorry.
So I don't think I ever was a criminal.
Okay. Because you said somewhere that you weren't...
I had become involved with the system, my first bout with the system. But in the States, when you say criminal is most like a mentality. And I think the word is used loosely. When they say career criminal, they apply that term to sometime an 18-year-old. And I wonder how can an 18-year-old who may have committed or may have been accused of committing a juvenile crime, went to juvenile, and then later on this individual, because of their record, his or her record, they may have committed another crime that requires some adult measures, and they get sent to prison, and they are labeled career criminals. So, and I wonder how in the world could that happen. I written something about that one time in the Anger Light while I was in prison. They were talking about people becoming career criminals. The career criminals to me are district attorneys, judges, all of these people who accept money for years and years and years, you know, who rapes the system, involve themselves in all type of corruptions and bribes they take. And over a career of 40 years, and then when they retire, the taxpayers, they get a pension from the taxpayer. To me, these are career criminals. Why would you apply that term? This is rhetorical. I ain't talking to you. But why would they apply that term to an individual who had a record as a juvenile, and which if you lived in the States and if you were black, you either had went to the army, or they had a place in juvenile detention for you, or prison. Mm. And I wonder why would they take and label these individuals as career criminals, especially when at 18 years old, they're in prison, and they've been in prison for some now. There are some people who are labeled career criminals who have been in prison now for 40 years when they were 20 years old. Yeah. They're 60 now. How can you continue to label them criminals or career criminals? Mm. Could never be. I call it, people think in a box. If they don't broaden their scope about what these terms mean. And there's no reflection on anybody. It's just that these are terms that people do not think or people do not really dissect. And I think they make a mistake in doing so. A career criminal is not an individual who's been in prison for 40 years and went there when he was 20. Even though they're labeled career criminal, they're not. To me, the career criminal is whom I described already.
Yeah. Sorry, I didn't mean to offend you.
No, I'm not offended.
No, very good. Because, yeah. I mean, you have said something along the lines of I wasn't an angel growing up or so.
It don't mean I was a criminal neither.
No.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
No, I wasn't an angel, meaning that I did not do it, meaning that, no. Look, I walked in stores, I was hungry, and I reached something off the shelf, and I've eaten it. That don't make me a criminal.
No.
I mean, you got judges do that. You got people who wake in high places. I was hungry.
Yeah.
And I walked in a place, I didn't, but I, you know, I didn't, you know, I wouldn't kill nobody for this. But if I walk in a place and saw something, and if I'm hungry and I eat it, I mean, I didn't consider myself a criminal. And I don't see, and I wouldn't see why nobody else would consider me a criminal. And when I say I wasn't an angel, it means this, that not that I was a devil. Mm-hmm. It means that one thing, I've done some things, refer to the fact that I wasn't an angel. I was trying to compare and make an assessment as to why I was. Of course, I was arrested for some things, and I let people know, you know, I wasn't a, quote, angel. And we use that term lightly, meaning that, you know, you did done some little devilish thing. And you might, when I say devilish thing, you do some things that goes against the grain of the system. Like some places you can't spit in society, but some people do it anyway. In that sense there, you know, I meant that in that sense, and not so much as I was a criminal. Okay. I didn't mean to associate the thing that I was doing when I say I wasn't an angel. I didn't mean for anyone to get the idea that I was a criminal either.
I'm thinking that from a structural sort of political standpoint, would you say that did you get the chances when growing up? Did you get the chances to become what you wanted?
No, I don't think. When you say, let me first, before I answer, when you say, did I get the chance? I didn't have the opportunity that the average white person had, or the white, young white person had in America. I didn't have the same opportunity. Did I get the chance? In most cases, no. There are some things that I wanted to do in life that had I gotten a chance, I probably would have done those things or had the opportunity. Had the time allowed me to take advantage of an opportunity, but I wasn't allowed to take advantage of certain opportunities because they weren't there for me.
What were your dreams growing up?
I really thought I was going to be the middleweight champ of the world. I used to love to fight. Over the ensuing years, I learned I wanted to really play football. I wasn't big enough to play football, but I wanted to as an alternative. And at one time, I wanted to go to the Army. Okay. I had this idea of going to the Army, and at one time went down to the U.S. Custom and tried to enlist. I was about maybe 17 at the time, but it didn't happen. That opportunity wasn't for me.
But you did get to do some boxing.
I did do some boxing.
Yeah.
I did some boxing, and because of the fact that I was rearrested and my parole was violated, the fact that, if you read this book, you get an idea as to what I'm saying, but I could give you. I was boxing, and I pointed out in the book, you know, that I did some boxing. I did semi-pro boxing. What happened was I had a previous record, and I was arrested, rearrested with a guy who had a record, and they violated my parole, and that sent me back. They kept me in jail. They put a hold on me. I got out on bond. I was arrested with this individual one night. And this guy I was on parole at the time. This guy had been a prisoner, but everybody in my neighborhood had been, all my uncles had been to prison. And on parole, you can't associate with someone who had been on prison. That means this, that even though they allowed me to go back to a neighborhood, I probably couldn't associate with nobody in the neighborhood because just about every young male in the neighborhood had some kind of juvenile record if you were black. You had a juvenile record that you have been arrested by the police and they could find a reason to violate you. And so they violated me because I was with a guy who had a previous record, not because I had done anything.
So if the police see you standing on the street talking to another person, they could imprison you for that?
They could arrest you for that. If they could say you look like somebody who committed a crime. In other words, they needed to clean the books on it. And perhaps if you read the portion in a book, it'll put in context what I'm saying because I can't just do it all in summarize it. Mm. But yeah, there was a law, now 72 law, that allowed them to arrest you, even though you may have you're standing on a corner and they would say you look like somebody who did this, and they'll take you to the precinct and they will keep you there for 72 hours. If you had a job, you won't have it when you come back. Mm. That because there was a law that stemmed from slavery. It was a 1872, but they call it a 72, where if there's no visible means of support, if you have no visible means of support, and this law ironically came out after slavery, where blacks had no visible means of support. They wanted to put them back either in prison or on a plantation. They couldn't put them back on a plantation. Some went back on a plantation and sharecropped. But if you didn't have a job, they could put you in jail and send you to prison. And in the ensuing days while you were held in prison on a 72, many people got picked up. And I mentioned it in the book, many people who got picked up on a 72 of no means of visible means of support. They had visible means of support, but they ended up in prison. And some never got out of prison because they ended up being coerced, forced, beaten to plead to a crime or to say that, yeah, well, I couldn't, because they didn't want to be terrorized by the police anymore. They did not want to be beaten by the police anymore. And I'm telling you, some of the biggest terrorists, you know, during that time, they were police. They knew how to terrorize the black community. And this is what it was. Yeah. This is what you had to deal with.
Perhaps a strange question, but do you love America?
I love the people in America. Mm. People in America are beautiful. Most people, they are beautiful. I mean, especially this day and time. And it's been like that always. I've never hated. I hate oppression. I grow to hate oppression and, you know, and terror tactics. I learned to hate this. But I don't attribute this to the people in America because, again, the majority of the people in America are beautiful. And then again, let me say this for the record, that, you know, some people think America is heaven. And guess what? America is heaven for some. You know, it is heaven for some. But for some, I let people know that for some, in heaven, there are some people catching hell. Over the years and over the period of the history of America, which is, quote, heaven, many people caught hell and many people still catching hell.
Are you hopeful about America?
Again, like I say, I am. Yes, I'm hopeful that because people are learning now that the hypocrisy that exists in America is not really what America could be and is. You mm-hmm. just have to eliminate the hypocrisy. And the people are not the one who makes the, you know, who erect laws that produces or induces hypocrites. I mean, it is those who imply those laws in one area to some people and misplace them with other people in other areas or misapply them in other areas with other people.
We talked about this before we started the interview, I think, that you actually made candy while in prison. How did you come up with that idea?
Well, it was a combination of ideas. It wasn't just me. I think it was Herman and I at that time. But I knew how to make candy before I went to pecan candy. We used to call them pralines at the time before I was sent to prison. I had learned how to make candy. And it's called praline. It's a New Orleans, it's a Southern product where it was a mixture of, you know, butter, vanilla, sugar, pecan and water or whatever, and, you know, and make candy in prison. I kind of, because it was just being in a cell, we were allowed cold drink cans, and came up with the idea that if we had aluminum cans that we could take the top off them and just make a handle, erect a crude handle made out of whatever with some form of wrap to make sure you didn't burn your hand. And we just, there was a toilet in our cell. We had toilet paper, and we would use toilet paper. You'd be surprised how hot aluminum can get, you know, if you wrap, we call it a burner. But you know what? I have this thing I would give you. If you probably go online, it ain't more than about 7 or 8 minutes.
No, I saw that.
I described the Kitchen Sisters.
Yeah.
Oh, you saw that?
Yeah, I saw that. Yeah,
well, that's what, yeah. And that's the way it was done. We had it. It was cruelly done.
And you
we,
can also,
in defiance of everything else, we weren't supposed to do that. But we also had people, you know, we were there for a while. And as long as the brass didn't come through and find out some things, we were doing some things, the sergeant or the person that were on, you know, they turn their back on you and let certain things happen, because I think some of them understood that, you know, you wasn't doing any major violating. You was just doing something might have been against prison rules, but the only, you know, you were doing something that was pretty good. And so they could turn their backs and turn their blind eye to it and say, just don't get caught. If you get caught or if the brass come through, then I'm going to have to write you up or I'm going to have to discipline you. But other than that, we were able to do it. That's how I was able to do it. Then a lot of time I got from the officers extra milk, extra butter or extra sugar. When I didn't get it from individuals on a till, sometimes I would ask the officer to go on another flat, on another till, and get it from someone else who was willing to share. I had people, because I used to send the candy and spray the candy out, and I used to give it to some guys on death row. And so I was able to, they'd get sugar every morning, sugar for breakfast, sugar for coffee, but people didn't use sugar. And I would ask them to save it for me. They would get butter or margarine. I would say, well, save that for me as well. And then when I accumulate enough of it, make candy. Mm. But I use, instead of water, I use milk. And when I got out, I just kind of perfected it a little more. I use two kinds of milk now, and I add a couple more ingredients to it.
And you sell it online?
I sell it online, yeah. I sell it online. It went good. The Kitchen Sisters, David Yanelson and Nikki, they did a lot, because right after Katrina, they did an interview, and the candy was, they featured the candy, but that was just the Hidden Kitchen was just a means of getting our story out. The story about the candy, I wasn't intrigued with that. Mm. What was more intriguing is NPR used that particular story to get the story of the Angola 3 out into the public in that particular phone with their show. And people all over the country who heard that program, it opened their hearts up. And especially it happened during a time when Katrina occurred. And people were impacted by that story that the Kitchen Sisters did with regards to the candy. But it wasn't about it was about Hidden Kitchen and the candy with them. But for me, it was more about the story that comes with the candy. And we were able to do something on NPR with Angola 3 that NPR didn't do with Mumia, because the Patrolman Association, when NPR was about to do a story on Mumia, there was some dissent with regards to the Philadelphia Police Benevolent Association, and they backed up, and they could not get his story out. But NPR, through the candy, got mine out, and David and Nikki did a good job. We are friends now. We are cool, and anytime they ask me to make candy, send candy, I say, they have a grandfather clause. They can get, I'll stop what I'm doing and make candy and ship to them. Mm-hmm.
When you got out of prison, did you get some kind of
no.
compensation?
No, they gave me a $10 check, and they should have gave me 20, but they gave me a $10 check and say that. And that really couldn't get me home. I couldn't. I was like 150 miles away from where I needed to go at. So good thing they had people waiting at the gate for me. But no, to make a long story short, no. They didn't. They gave me a $10 check. And unfortunately, I should have kept that check, but I needed the money, and so I cashed it. But I should have kept that check to show. But no, I haven't been compensated for it.
And you will never be?
No, not the fact that I was in prison all that time. But what may happen is I could be compensated, because we filed a civil lawsuit against my being held in solitary confinement for those many years, and the court agreed that my 29 years constituted cruel and unusual punishment. And so, therefore, this is pending. Actually, I will go see Woodfox, because we are still part of a civil litigation against the state of Louisiana, because we filed, and the court ruled in Sam as to Woodfox and to Herman, who's now deceased, but it ruled that. It ruled that my time placed in solitary confinement was cruel and unusual, and this is something that's pending. So I might, because we asked for punitive damage and compensatory damage.
Of course.
So we may receive some funds as a result of that whenever that case settled. But it's been going on for 17, 18 years. It hasn't occurred. It hasn't happened yet. And it's been combined. The civil case and the criminal case are combined together.
Well, I wish you, I hope that you get to finish that soon.
Yeah, hopefully it will be. There are a few things that should have been done, but it hasn't happened. It should have been over with. It's just a boat.
Yeah, it's a boat. Okay. Where do you live now, sir?
I live in Austin.
Why?
No reason why. I mean, Katrina, because I lost wherever I was living at, the infrastructure. Even though I was there during the time of Katrina, the house was unlivable. I was no longer staying in that place at the time. But I was there until I could get out, until the water just recede and go down, until I was getting ready to travel to Portugal during the time I was first going to California. Before Katrina happened, that stopped me from the weather. It kind of held things up, but I was supposed to leave from there, from California, and go to Portugal, in which I did, but I was delayed. And, you know, when I was through, I had in my mind probably to go live in California, somewhere in California, in maybe Oakland. But I changed my mind. I thought Austin, Texas would be a better place. I had plans. I said, well, you know, Austin is a nice place. Anyway, in Texas, I would live, it would be Austin. And so Austin was the place that I chose. Mm. So that's the reason why I'm in Austin now. It's not because I couldn't not be in other places, not because I couldn't be in New Orleans if I wanted to, but I don't want to be in New Orleans. And again, like I say, I had planned to leave New Orleans long before Katrina occurred. It's just I was waiting for the right time, and Katrina provided me with the opportunity to do so at the time that I did.
Do you like it in Austin?
I love it in Austin. Yeah, I love it in Austin. It's laid back. It's cool. It's pretty decent. Yeah.
You were in prison for 31 years. I mean, we talked about food earlier, but how about sex?
How about sex? You don't get, they weren't going to get your woman in yourself.
Of course. I mean, you must have thought tons of sex.
Of course I thought about it, but, I understood where I was. And of course, you know, I understood where I was, and I understood that was something not so much as I couldn't do. I couldn't have what they call sex in prison because where we were, there was no women. And don't get me wrong, I don't have anything against, gays or anything like that, homosexual. I don't nothing at all. It's just that it wasn't our thing. It wasn't my thing. We felt, and I felt personally, being in prison, I felt that we were all getting had by the system. And a lot of time in prison, in a situation like that, where sex are denied, you are denied sex, then you create means of having sex. And in the process of creating means, there are people who come to prison who are what people may call weaker inmates who can be subjected to and coerced, and intimidated into being your outlet for your feeling. And that was a thing that I felt personally was more oppressive than the system itself. Why would you subject someone, in a situation like this to that? So, no, it was beyond my belief, but it was also against the Black Panther Party idea to rape other individuals. And this is one of the only way that you can perhaps have in a cell or in a false situation. We were not in a dormitory where there were some gays or some people who wanted this to happen. And then again, it just wasn't my forte.
No.
Of course, if you want to ask me, would I masturbate it? Of course, I masturbated.
Yeah, no, I'm not going to ask you that because
was cracked up. I mean, you say, well, what did I do for sex? I could have just made a long story short and say, I masturbated.
Yeah, of course you did. But my question is, when you got out?
Of course, when I got out, I stayed with a woman who came to whom I met a lot of people over the years, and I stayed with a lady for 4 or 5 years, Marion Brown. She lives in. She was a former member of the Black Panther Party, whom I knew before I went to prison.
Okay,
she had went to California. She had really married. She and her husband were separated. She had a son, and she got heard about our case, and she started coming to see us. And she started just maybe a year or so before I was released. And once I was released, she was one of the ones who came was at the gate. So we kind of got together once I got out. About a week or so, we talked and realized that we might could make this work. And we got together and we stayed together for some years.
And you didn't remember the first thing you ate when you came out. But do you remember?
It was a roast beef. It was a roast beef sandwich.
Yeah.
But now at home, home-cooked meal, it probably was maybe some seafood gumbo or something like that.
But do you remember the first time you had sex?
I do.
Yeah.
It was about with Marion, yeah, of course. Yeah. It was Marion it was less than a week before I got
out. It must have been wonderful.
It was, but you have to realize this, that you had been away from that for a minute, so you have to get back in the groove. But of course, you long for it. It took a while, the compatibleness of what you're doing was something that you have to, you know, want to do. And it was enjoyable, of course.
Yeah. Thank you so much for sharing that. I mean, way too personal. I'm blushing. Would you like to recommend anything?
No, I would like just, you know, I just like to continue to say, I believe this, that the listeners, especially to people here, Mayai is, you know, she has done a noble thing in learning about this case, and she has taken the initiative to embrace our cause. And we are very grateful, and we're asking people to embrace Mayai. She is launching a record called Yellow Ribbon, and she's, from what I gather, she's taking it upon herself to contribute, you know, also to our cause, whatever she get out of this. And she did not have to do this, but just the mere fact of our being associated with her, you know, has give us a broader platform and give us another audience, and we really do appreciate this. So we ask the listeners, if they want to support us, to support me. Yeah.
Very good.
Cool.
Who do you think I should interview on Varvet International?
Well, maybe you ought to answer. Governor Jindal is going to be here in UK. He has been given a forum to speak on human rights. His desire is to probably either become a nominee for president of the United States, or he want to run on a ticket with someone. I would like to interview him and want to know, why is he, of course, you could get information, you could get it. He is, like I say, he's going to be at the UK embassy speaking on human rights.
Okay.
The question need to be asked, are you familiar with the case of the Angola 3? And what do you believe about this? Have you done anything to offset this injustice, since you are so much, you know, involved in the injustice? My question would be, you know, your question would be to him, what have you done, you know, to exact justice for these men? All of the evidence been overturned in this case. Two federal judges have overturned it. It waiting to be an en banc. Robert King brought, along with Cedric Richmond, before he became congressman, brought thousands of petitions to your desk twice, in which you've rejected those petitions. You did not meet with them. Now you are interested in the implementation of justice. You know, a human rights violation. What is being done when Amnesty has gotten on board? So many people around the world has gotten on board that this is the thing that is happening, has happened to the Angola 3 in your town. What have you done, or what is being done about it? And see what he said.
Perfect. Thank you so much for your time, sir.
Thank you.
That's Mr. Robert King. I'm very happy and honored to have met him, and humbled. And if you would like to know more about the Angola 3, there is a documentary called The Angola 3. It came out in 2008. It's a really good movie. And there's also a website called angola3.org, where you can check what you can do, and or you could buy the Mayai song on iTunes. It's called Yellow Ribbon, and Mayai, I pronounce it in Swedish. It's supposedly pronounced Meja in English, M-E-J-A. Thank you so much for listening. Thank you, Uber, for sponsoring the show. And listeners, don't forget to use Varvet as referral code when you start an account if you are in Sweden. I would like to thank Lovisa Olsson for editing. I would like to thank Christina Jörling-Biro for producing. I will talk to you in 2 weeks if you want to. I hope you do. Bye-bye for now.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50% to 80% less than similar brands. Plus,
Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.